All right, let's go ahead and get started, and we'll be joined by a few more people as they get their luggage to the dock and get down here. My name is David Mazenbring. I work at St. Mark's Episcopal Cathedral in Seattle, where I serve as pastor for Church in the World Ministries. That's just how we describe how we be a church in the world. So I do this work with the social justice ministers of the congregation and the ecumenical interfaith work. This is the 10th of 10 sessions over the last 2 weeks under the heading of blind spots among fools for Christ. What are some of the blind spots that we miss as we search for the wisdom of God? And the blind spots today can kind of be summed up as the martyrs. This session is called Steve Biko of South Africa, and he is one martyr of our time who, if he had not been killed in police custody on September 12th, 1977, would, I'm convinced, be the president of South Africa today. He was a remarkable human being for his ability to relate people opposed to one another. I met him on three occasions. One was a very curious chance encounter where Father Aylward Stubbs, a Community of the Resurrection priest who died 2 years ago, and who knew Steve better than any other white man, Donald Woods notwithstanding. Woods is the white South African journalist who wrote a book, rushed to press with a book after Biko's death called Biko, that I maintain would have been better called Woods. And it served as the basis for the film called Biko that Richard Attenborough did, which was a box office flop, because the financiers who really determine the content of movies, usually a good year before they hit the box office, the financial people at the time that the film Biko was being prepared felt that the American public was not ready for a mass market of a film that had a black hero. They said the movie-going public needs someone they can identify with. So if you've seen, how many have seen the film Biko? A couple of you. If someday you do happen to see it, you'll find that Biko dies one third of the way into the film. And Donald Woods is the ongoing character around whom the audience is supposed to identify with. Well, what the financiers didn't bargain for was that after they made their editorial decisions based on their hope for their investments, and before the film came out, TransAfrica, which billed itself as a black lobby in Washington, D.C., or a lobby for Africa and the Caribbean in Washington, D.C., TransAfrica made news by beginning to demonstrate in front of South African embassies. Most of you look like you're old enough to remember the mid-80s, and that time in our history when it became very popular to get arrested in front of a South African consulate or South African embassy or South African interest section in the major cities around the country. And literally hundreds and hundreds of people were arrested demonstrating against the apartheid regime. That was a black-led movement. And when the film came out shortly after that time, all of the reviewers kind of said, oh, this is a disappointing film. The guy we want to learn about dies early in the movie. So the film also, by the way, sent into a deep depression one of its chief characters, the lady, black lady doctor, who was featured in that film and who was very close to Steve, was so depressed by how the media entertainment industry took the guy she knew and used his name to create a story about someone else. So, enough about the book called Biko, which came out first by Donald Woods. Secondly, there was a book edited by a African-American attorney in Washington, D.C. called Steve Biko Black Consciousness or something or another. And it was edited versions of a famous trial that Steve testified at. He was never charged with any crime. When he was picked up and held in police custody, it was without charge. He was never charged with a crime, but he did serve state's witness, not state's was defense, served as a witness for the defense in a very famous trial of the Black Consciousness Movement. And excerpts from that trial testimony form the basis of that second book and a couple of chapters in this book. This was the third book to come out. They were generally all three reviewed together. They got major publicity because his death had generated so much publicity. So the New York Review of Books, for example, did all three books together at the same time, consistently said, this is the one that's really interesting, but it was the third one out. Didn't capture much of the early market. There are five languages, language editions of the book now. It's stayed continuously in print for over 30 years, and the current U.S. edition is published by the University of Chicago Press. Steve Biko, I Write What I Like, edited by Stubbs, with a memoir at the back. Aylward had introduced Steve and I to each other. Steve said, actually it was a coincidence that I happened to run into them on the afternoon. And Aylward said, come here, I want you to meet this guy. And when I met him, he said, oh, Aylward was just telling me about you this morning. Why don't you come and see me sometime? So I was glad to arrange a trip to do that about a month and a half later, in January of 77. And then in June of 77, I went back to see him with a burning question. And on August 18th of 77, he was, I'll say more, he was picked up and killed in police custody less than a month later. So a word about the book, which I'm going to read from after I give you a few biographical details about this man who I earlier called a martyr of our time. The book has a memoir at the back written by the white person who knew him best, Aylward Stubbs, and is useful for conveying some biographical details. It's not a biography. It comes after a wide set of writings from him that are set in chronological order. And it's all of those reasons, it's not a book I recommend you start on page one and read all the way through. By the way, this is what the edition in the bookstore looks like. I'm going to read from this one because it's already marked up and I have the page numbers and I know where to find what I want to find. But this is the one you can buy in the bookstore. Right after Steve's death, Aylward smuggled a note to me and said, I've been asked to do, shortly before Steve's death, this white person who knew him better than anyone else, than any other white, had been refused re-entry to South Africa. He's a Brit, so he didn't need a visa. He went home to visit his dying mother. While he was at home in England, the South African embassy sent a representative to him and said, delivered papers to him saying, you are not allowed to return to South Africa. So he was excluded from returning to the land in which he had lived for over 30 years. And it was shortly after that that Steve was accidentally caught at a roadblock set up for another purpose, violating his banning orders, restricting him to a given police district. But he regularly would do that. He was a banned individual, but he believed very strongly that fear is the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor. In fact, that's a direct quote from him. And that it was important to recognize that the system, which was the name for the South African Security Police, the system couldn't monitor all the mail it wanted to, couldn't tap all the phone calls it wanted to, couldn't spy on all the people it wanted to all the time. And so Steve was a great proponent that you just got to do what you need to do and trust that most of the time you won't get caught. So this banned individual, restricted to his hometown of King Williamstown, would show up in Port Elizabeth, the big city, 2 or 3 hours drive away. He'd show up in the black township in Port Elizabeth and get back home to his police district where he was restricted before the authorities knew he had been there. And the word would spread like wildfire through Port Elizabeth. Biko was here, you know, and people would, that was a huge thing because everyone knew he was banned. And the fact that he ignored his banning order like that made him a folk hero of sorts, or contributed to his popularity among black people. He was on a trip to Cape Town to negotiate some reconciliation strategy between the ANC and the PAC. The two African National Congress and the Pan-Africanist Congress were the two black liberation movements, quote unquote, that had been banned by the South Africans in the early 60s and forced underground in South Africa and outside of the country. And they were infamous within the black community in South Africa for fighting with each other. And Steve was on a mission to strategize some reconciliation between them, and had gone to a meeting in Cape Town, and on his way back got caught at a checkpoint that was set up for another purpose. And when they realized who they had, they grabbed him. He was quickly turned by the police over to the secret police and eventually, as we know, beaten to death. After his death, Aylward smuggled a letter to me and said, "I've been asked by a British publisher to do a biography of Biko. Would you go see the family and friends?" And gave me a list of people to talk to and see what they say, and then come and see me. He, by that time, was resident in Lesotho, a tiny little mountain country, landlocked by South Africa. So you'd fly through Jan Smuts Airport to Lesotho. And so I went and saw the family, his widow, his mother, met with Donald Woods, interestingly enough, who was very curious that there was this other book, because he was already at work on his own book at that point. Talked to several other people and then went to see Aylward and made a case that a biography of a man whose bottom line said, white people don't speak for blacks, blacks speak for themselves. A biography of such a man needs to be done by his own community, not by a white man. And in any event, such a biography will have to interview a lot of his contemporaries. Steve was killed on September 12th. October 16th, just a month later, was a massive crackdown on his black consciousness movement. I forget, maybe 16 organizations? At least a dozen different organizations were all banned. A lot of individuals were banned. A lot of people were rounded up and taken into police custody without charge again. So late October, when Aylward had sent me this note, when I went and saw him, I said, "Look, a lot of people who need to contribute to the biography are in police custody. We don't know when they're getting out, number one. Number two, you're a white man. The biography needs to be done by his own people." It has still not been done, by the way. So in any event, the way he represented himself was so compelling. His own writing was so compelling. Why not just collect some of his writings, which are banned and therefore not legal for possession in South Africa, let alone publication, but important while we still can to gather these fragments, put them together in a book of his own writings, and then Aylward, you add a memoir, which doesn't claim the objectivity of a biography. You write a personal memoir of how you knew him and stick that at the back. So, this is a long way of saying what I recommend you do is read a couple of the finest chapters here that you don't need any background for, to get a taste of his style, and then jump ahead to the memoir, read the memoir so you understand some of the circumstances of his life, and then you can go back and read any of the chapters and they will make some sense. Steve was about 14, 15 years old when Nelson Mandela went to prison. a watershed event in the history of South Africa, because during the 1950s.
What year was that, David?
63. I'm trying to remember, and I didn't, this being the 10th of 10 sessions, most of which I have never done before, and I need to do a lot of prep work. I'm embarrassed to say I don't remember. Was he 30 years old or 31 when he died in 1977? 29. He was born in about 47, 48. He was an early teenager in 1963 when Mandela went to prison. Following a period of the 1950s which had been the most politically active in the history of South Africa, a time that black people had tremendous hope in their ability to finally overcome this white racist regime. And they did so with massive campaigns of civil disobedience. By the end of the 50s, the system, the government, had so blocked nonviolent resistance that Nelson Mandela and a few others had turned to sabotage, not terrorism, you know. I mean, they were very careful to spare human life at that point, but blowing up a power line, for example, had begun to explore some violent means of trying to get the attention of the white government. In any event, Mandela's caught in about 61, and by 63, he's sent off to Robben Island. And protest in South Africa came to a complete halt. Now, if you're a 12, 14-year-old kid, when everything shuts down, very disconcerting. And the period from 63 through the rest of the 60s, through to about 1970, was a dead period in terms of political activity within the black community. And that's very significant, because that's when Biko is moving through secondary school. In 1963, is that right? At the beginning of the memoir, Aylward talks about how he first got to know the family. And that was because he had been asked by an Anglican priest. May of 63, Steve's older brother and 40 of his fellow students at a secondary school called Lovedale Institution in the Eastern Cape were arrested and charged with membership in an unlawful organization, Boko, a Pan-Africanist Congress militant wing. I don't know if it was true that Steve's brother was part of that or not, but he was, as a secondary school student, rounded up and charged with this crime. And five of those 40 students were Anglicans, and the priest guardian of one of them kind of came to know that they were Anglicans, felt some pastoral responsibility for these kids who had been arrested and were going to be charged with political crimes. And word came to Aylward Stubbs, there's someone whose family, the family of one of these kids, Kaya, lives nearby you, Aylward, and will you take a pastoral interest in the family? So Aylward went to meet the family. As Steve's mother, the father was absent, Steve's mother and her four children, one of whom, the younger one of whom, was Steve. Aylward establishes a pastoral, now this is important for two reasons. Aylward got pastorally involved with the family and came to be seen as kind of the family's priest, or a white priest who they could turn to in times of trouble. And at a later point, when Steve is in secondary school, he sends a letter to Aylward Stubbs. He's been studying at a boarding school, for a Catholic boarding school, and he sends this letter to Stubbs with a list of questions about religion and Christianity. And Aylward remembers the letter because it was so articulate, and the guy was so thoughtful on the kinds of challenging questions he was asking. The other reason the story is significant is because Steve, as a youngster, had an older brother who experienced firsthand how the political system worked. For example, the lawyer that most of these 40 kids had chosen, on the eve of the trial's opening, is detained by the security police. You know, I mean, that's how the system worked. And was an early an early lesson for a youngster growing up. To cut to the chase, growing up during that dead political time, he founded a movement that was incapable of being suppressed by controlling or detaining or getting rid of a few key leaders. And so the Black Consciousness Movement worked not around the leadership of a few, the way it had in the 1950s. And then you take Robert Sobukwe and Nelson Mandela and a few others and put them on Robben Island, and the whole movement comes to a stop. Biko founded a movement that could not be stopped by eliminating a few leaders. How did he do that? And significant for those of us who live in a continuing racist society, I'll make a little political aside here, because over the last 2 weeks, a lot of people said, oh, you know, from the heartland, there's a lot of people who are just not going to vote for Obama because he's black. And I said, well, then you just tell them you're glad that it's coming out in the open that we have a racist society, instead of pretending that we don't have racism. When you run into that, you just say, well, good, at least our racism is becoming evident here. And how are we ever going to work on it? That's my political speech. So as long as race matters, it's important to get a little insight to the resources of this book for addressing the problem of racism. In the 1960s, when Steve goes off to secondary school, late during his secondary school career, he gets involved with NUSAS, National Union of South African Students. You know that in South Africa you had two white cultures, Afrikaners speaking Afrikaans language, English speaking English. The English claimed to be the liberals. They were basically jealous of the fact that beginning in 1948, the Afrikaners came to power. These two white races fought a war against each other at the turn of the 20th century, about 1900, and they disliked each other greatly. And though the English were ascendant during the early decades of the 20th century, and then the Afrikaners come to power, and the British resent that. So they became liberals mostly because they were anti-Afrikaners, I think. The English liberals, whites, in direct opposition to the Afrikaner ethic of apartheid, separation of the races, form a multiracial students organization led by liberal whites. And Biko gets involved at the end of his secondary school career and continues involved when in 1966 or 7, he goes off to medical school. There's a black medical school, and this guy, being bright, goes there and becomes heavily involved in NUSAS for about a year and a half. NUSAS and also the World